Sangye chutang su ki cho nam la Jang chu bar du da mi kya su chi Da gi jin so yi pi so nam gi Ro la pin chi sangye du par shu I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, Siddhartha, and the assembly of saints. From the virtuous merits that I collect, by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, Siddhartha, and the assembly of saints. From the virtuous merits that I collect, by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings never be separated from the bliss which is sorrowless. May all dwell in equanimity, free from aversion and incline. The ground is covered with flowers and sprinkled with scented water. In the middle is Mount Meru, surrounded by the four continents and ornamented by the sun and the moon. By visualizing all this and offering it as a Buddha realm, may all sentient beings partake of the Buddha's pure lands. Om Guru Buddha Bodhisattva Sapariwara Ratnamanda Buddha Mega Sambuddha Saparana Samaye
Okay, welcome. So, just to figure out where we are, we've gone through the impure vision and we're in the vision of experience. And we went through relative enlightenment thought, the three stages of analytical meditation, loving kindness and compassion. And then the enlightenment thought has wishing entering, which is the relative. And now we're in the section on the ultimate. And just a reminder, when we're talking, we need to be really clear or reading, are we talking about relative truth or ultimate truth? Because the point of view changes a little bit and the language changes a little bit, and it's easy to get confused, and also, especially if we're talking to somebody else, if they're talking about relative and we're talking about ultimate or vice versa, we need to be on the same page. So just a reminder to keep that in mind. And also when we're reading, it's the same thing. We're in the section on ultimate enlightenment thought. We went through the nature of it, the method of producing it, and then the matter of practice, we went through calm abiding, and we're now in insight wisdom. Okay, so just this is the map of where we've come from and where we are, and where we're going is over here at the merging. Okay, so we're in insight wisdom. We're kind of in the middle of it. And we arrived at page 183. I hope people had a chance to look at page 182, though, because there's sort of two parts to this. There's the mind-only school, and there's the middle way school. So again, there's another subdivision that we need to be aware of what we're talking about. So we basically went through the mind-only school, which also has subdivisions to it, of course, like everything. But we're not going to go into a lot of detail about the subdivisions. But basically, the mind-only school posits that external phenomena are illusory. They're a projection of our mind. That's kind of the simple way of saying it. And some of the mind-only philosophers believe that the mind is real, is not an illusion. We're going to find out that middle way doesn't accept that. So I just want to give that overview that, so that once we get into this, people have some idea what we're talking about. And this is pretty advanced stuff, so it takes a little bit of reading, contemplation, and meditation. It's only when you get into the meditation stage that you actually realize it. So that, I think, is worth saying, too. But we have to sort of sort it out intellectually first. Otherwise, we don't know what we're meditating on. So we're going to go through some of the sorting here now.
183
at the top.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thanks very much.
So is that clear as mud, or do we need to talk about that some more just to get to where we are?
Well, it's a process.
Yeah. Any questions about what I just said or where we are? Oh, everybody. Okay, good. Okay, so we stopped right at the top of the page where it says, therefore one should know that the root of all happiness and suffering of samsara and nirvana is one's own mind, which is self-cognizing and self-illuminating. Now, we didn't talk about that a lot, but basically our mind has an awareness aspect to it. We are aware of things with our mind, right? We did the little experiment where you pinch your arm, right? You remember that? We feel that our awareness goes there. And then the other aspect is this clear light aspect of it. So one should constantly maintain certainty that all the various appearances of subject and object that arise due to the power of the deluded mind itself possess no real nature of their own. So when we say real nature, we're talking about it being independent, permanent, not dependent on any other causes and conditions. And that we say that we don't believe it, but we actually act as if things were permanent, solid, independent. We live our lives in that delusion mostly, most of us. Okay? So that's the cause of our problems. That's one of the reasons we suffer, is we don't perceive things correctly. And so we need to clean that up. And that's why we're learning to do these meditations. Otherwise, you stay in samsara indefinitely and suffer indefinitely. We don't want that, right? In that state of meditation, one should look directly without any obscuration at the self-radiance of the appearance of the clear mind. Now, we previously talked about this in the calm abiding section. Does anybody remember how we get to this point of this clarity? Remember when
one-pointed meditation?
Yeah, we do one-pointed meditation on what?
An object of virtue.
Yeah, first of all, we have an object, or a virtuous object. Could be a physical object like a stone or a picture or the blue flower. And we train our mind to focus on that. We do short sessions, frequent sessions, remember that discussion? Until we learn through focusing that our discursive thoughts just kind of dissolve. We don't try to force our mind to stop thinking, because that's a losing battle. You'll just make it more agitated if you've ever tried. It doesn't work. But when we develop calm abiding, eventually the discursive monkey mind kind of calms down and settles down like silt in water, yeah? And there are these gaps or spaces. And eventually, if we keep doing this, we start having glimpses of the clear light, okay? That's sort of the substratum underneath everything. And when that happens, what do? We shift our focus from
to internal.
From outside to inside. Yeah. Once we reach that point, we leave our external object and we start to focus on the clear light itself. And then we develop or expand that. Okay, so we already covered that before, so that's where we're at here in this paragraph. So in that state of meditation, one should look directly without any obscuration at the self-radiance of the appearance of the clear mind. If a stream of thoughts arise, then having cut off whatever has arisen, be more attentive to producing sharper clarity of mind in meditation. So how do we do that? How do we actually, what are the mechanics of cutting off those thoughts?
Just becoming aware of them in the first place.
That's right. And then what do we do?
And then refocusing.
Yeah, we apply the antidotes. Remember the antidotes? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we apply the antidotes.
I just tell myself not to engage.
Sorry?
I just say don't engage.
Yeah. So when if a thought does arrive, you notice it, and then you apply the antidote. So in other words, you go back to your focus. If a stream of thoughts arise, then having cut off whatever has arisen, be more attentive to produce sharper clarity of mind in meditation. Having meditated in that way, one will experience in one's meditation the distinct clarity of mind. So in other words, the more you practice this, the more clarity of mind becomes evident to you. Also, subsequent to that meditation, a very sharp memory will be produced in oneself. So it doesn't just stop when you're sitting on the cushion, but when you actually get up, you still have some experience of that. You have some memory of that. So, up to this point, all of these stages of the method to meditate upon the ultimate truth are in common with the Yogacharya school. Yogacharya is just another name for mind only. Okay, which we've covered previously on the previous page. And as it was said in the compendium of the essence of the mind by Shantideva, the ocean-like Mahayana treatise of the Yogacharya school proclaimed that there is a consciousness in ultimate truth which is free from object and subject. In other words, they say the mind is real. Okay. Now, we're going to go to point number two, and this is the section on the realization of selflessness. Okay. So the second point under the topic of realization for selflessness. Does somebody want to read that? Number two?
All right.
Okay.
Keep the mind in the state free from conceptual extremes. It may be asked, well then, is there a truly existent consciousness which is free from subject and object, as one of the branches of the Yogacara school believes? There is not, since what is to be refuted, the subject and object, are not existent. There cannot be a truly existent consciousness that is devoid of both subject and object which have already been denied. If it does exist, how is its existence known? One might think, its existence can be established through experiencing it at the time of its existence. But is it possible for consciousness to simultaneously function as two aspects of what is to be known and the knower? Just as the blade of a sword cannot cut itself, and the flame of a lamp cannot illuminate itself.
Okay, so now we're in the middle way school philosophy. Basically what they're going to argue is it's impossible for the mind to simultaneously function as two aspects of what is to be known and the knower, just like a blade of a sword cannot cut itself. So they're refuting the mind-only position that the mind is real. They agree that the mind is the cause of you know, the projection of the mind is the cause of all of our experience. But they're denying that that mind itself is real. They're saying that mind is also empty. So the mind-only school emphasizes the clarity aspect. Middle way school emphasizes the emptiness aspect. So we have the appearance of clarity, but it's empty. It's not inherently existent. It's not permanent. It's not solid. Okay. So they're going to now go through the rationalization of how they arrived at the position that the mind is empty. It's not inherently existent. And they're going to quote Shantideva.
As it was said in the Bodhicaravatara, just as a sword blade cannot cut itself, so too mind cannot perceive itself. Further, in the same text it was said, the lamp is not illuminatable because it is not obscured by darkness. Likewise, it was stated in the
Madhyamaka Avatara.
If there is an entity, the dependent mind, Paritantra, which is emptied by the freedom from object and subject, how will one know its existence? It is incorrect to establish an existent something which cannot be grasped. Its existence cannot be established through it experiencing itself.
So that's just kind of a fancy way of saying if the mind is truly existent, we should be able to find it.
Hence, the past mind, having become extinct, is not existent. And it is not correct to consider that which is extinct to be an entity. The future mind, not yet having been born, does not exist, and it is contradictory to consider that which has not been born to be an entity. The present mind has no form, no color, and it does not abide inside the body nor outside the body. However much one may search for it, one will not find it. Therefore, it is devoid of existence. The reason that the mind has no color and no form was taught in the...
I don't have the English for that.
Vairochana.
Vairochana Abhisambodhi.
Guhyapati. Sorry?
Mm-hmm.
The mind was not seen by the Buddhas. It is not seen, and it will not be seen. The mind is not blue, not yellow, not red, not white, not orange, and it is not of the color of glass, i.e. transparent. The mind is neither short, nor long, nor round, nor square. It is neither light nor dark. The mind is neither masculine nor feminine, nor of neutral gender. Guhyapati, the mind is not of the nature of the realm of desire. It is not of the nature of the realm of form, nor is it of the nature of the formless realm. The reason that the mind abides neither outside the body nor inside the body was stated in the...
Yeah, a sutra.
Kasyapa. The mind is neither inside the body nor outside the body nor in between the two. The mind is non-perceptible because of its non-existence.
Okay, so let's pause here. When it says non-existence, are we talking on the relative level or are we talking on the ultimate level?
Ultimate
level. Yeah. Because if we were talking on the relative level, why is it this and not this? Why is it ultimate and not relative?
Because we're in a state of meditation, right? Like if you're looking for a mind, you have to be in a state of meditation. I don't know that you could look for a mind without being consumed or wanting to get there.
Okay.
Right?
So, if I say, like the scripture says, these are the scriptural basis. The mind is non-perceptible because it is non-existence. Because of its non-existence. If I were to say that on the relative level, is that a true statement?
Mm-mm.
Why not?
Does anybody?
Go for it.
Because, okay, it seems like that's the way we perceive. Like it's we're here, we're now. Like there has to be kind of like a, how do you say it? Like I'm trying to look for. There's a specific word that I want to use. If it comes up to me, I'll say it. But a practicality, like relative, like things are relative, and there's a practicality within that, and and that's why we use relative mind. It's actually useful, but there is the importance of ultimate, where things just become undefinable, and I think that's like the nature of peace. Like it's like we all come together, so we must, I think, have a relative mind to make sense of things to get to an ultimate state where it's like you surpass that.
Yeah, good. Okay, she studied her homework, even if we didn't have homework. Remember we talked about the two extremes, this was a few weeks ago, we talked about the two extremes. We want to avoid the two extremes because we that's where middle way comes from. It's the middle way between the two extremes. So do you remember what the two extremes are?
Nihilism.
Nihilism and eternalism, right? So if I say, if I were to say something is non-existent, that's not nihilism or nihilism, right? It's denial of existence. Mm-hmm. And that's an extreme. We've already said we want to avoid that. So it doesn't work on the relative level to say that. But if I'm talking about the ultimate level, when we talk about non-existence on the ultimate level, what are we talking about?
Emptiness.
Yeah. Or, you want to elaborate more?
Enlightenment?
No. It doesn't exist independently, permanently. There's a bunch of words that we use to describe this.
Well, defining emptiness.
Right? Yeah.
Independent of anything else.
Yeah. This is an example of what I was saying a minute ago, that we need to be careful which we're talking about, relative or ultimate, because they're actually, in this case, they're actually sort of opposites. And so, in this case, what they're talking about is the mind is non-perceptible because of its non-existence. In other words, it's not permanently existence. I can't point to it and say it's there, which is what we usually tend to do with things, but it's not true. We're caught up in that delusion. Is that
clear?
Mm-hmm. Does somebody else want to read for a while?
I'll read for
a
little bit. The reason that however much one may search for it, one will not find the mind was stated in the same discourse. Kaspatyapa, if that mind is thoroughly searched for, it will not be found. Whatever entity cannot be found is non-perceptible due to its non-existence. Whatever entity is non-perceptible exists neither in the past nor in the future nor in the present. Whatever entity exists neither in the past nor in the future nor in the present has completely gone beyond the three times. Also, it was said in a sutra, Devaputra, all phenomena are merely mind. That mind cannot be shown. It is without barriers, without form, and it cannot be discerned. Even though the mind be thoroughly searched for by that true nature of mind, it cannot be found. That very mind, which is in the process of searching for itself, is non-perceptible. Since it is non-perceptible, one should view all phenomena as non-perceptible.
Okay, so the middle way is giving its reasons here, and the conclusion basically is all phenomena should be viewed as non-perceptible. That's what we call the selflessness of self and the selflessness of others.
Okay. It may be asked, what is the reason for failing to obtain the mind when it is thoroughly searched for? It is answered that the reason for this is that the mind was never born. If mind originates, then where does it originate from? Is it born from its extinct cause or from a non-extinct one? Is it incorrect to think that mind...
No, it is incorrect.
It is incorrect to think that mind originates from its extinct cause because something extinct is insubstantial. Therefore, it is impossible for an entity to arise from an insubstantial entity, nor can mind originate from a non-extinct cause. Because if a result originates from a non-extinct cause, then cause and result will exist simultaneously. Thus, there is no cause that produced the mind in the beginning. Without its origination, there can be no essence of its abiding in the middle. Without its abiding, there is no result of its cessation in the end. In this way, the mind is like space, being free from birth, cessation, and abiding. as Jetsun Rinpoche said in a song, in the beginning mind was never born, so how is it possible for that mind to abide and to cease, since the very thought of non-origination and non-cessation is a conceptualization, it should be discarded. That very act of discarding should also be discarded. Discarding itself is just a conceptualization.
Okay. So we're getting into the philosophy here. Basically, what this saying is that the mind is beginningless. And that is, not all religions say that. In other words, a lot of belief systems have a creator, you know, or the Big Bang Theory or whatever. Buddhism says, no, it's beginningless. Our mind is beginningless. And Sakyatrichin, the 41st Sakyatrizin, said, that's one of the real mysteries of life. It's just kind of beyond. I mean, even he was kind of going, wow. It's kind of amazing to think about. But that is the basis of what they're talking about here, is the reason you can't find the mind is it's beginningless. There's nothing that caused it. You can trace it back to you. There's no causes and conditions there. And that's why you see this referred to all the time here in this book, you know, the fact that we're in this deep, deep, deep habit pattern of thinking we have an ego and thinking everything is solid and real. And it's because we've been doing this since beginningless time. And we're going to see some examples, maybe tonight, but certainly in this text, where they talk about from the beginning or in the beginning and since the beginning. And I'm not sure, because I can't read the Tibetan text, if it's actually worded that way or if the translators translated it that way. But we should be careful when we run into those kind of phrases that we understand that it doesn't really mean from the beginning or in the beginning. What it really means is from beginningless time. So be careful when you're reading the text that you don't think they're saying one thing when they're really not. They're saying another thing.
Thank you.
Okay?
Would somebody else like to take over? I'll use my voice.
It may be asked, well then, is that non-existence of mind the ultimate truth? It is answered that since the existence of mind could not be established, the non-existence of that mind, whose existence has been refuted, cannot exist. As it was said in Bodhicaryavatara, when it is said that some entity does not exist, and that entity which is under examination is not apprehended, then at that time, how will that insubstantial entity, which is devoid of a support, remain before the mind? In this way, since existence and non-existence are contradictory, the mind cannot be both existent and non-existent. Since mind is not both existent and non-existent together, so the mind is also not neither existent nor non-existent, both of which have already been refuted. Therefore, the mind is free from the four conceptual extremes. As it was said in the Janasara Samachaya, the learned do not accept consciousness to exist in the ultimate truth, because it is devoid of the nature of singularity and plurality, like a sky flower. The mind is not existent, not non-existent, not both existent and non-existent, and not neither existent nor non-existent. The true nature of mind is free from the four conceptual extremes. Thus, the followers of the Madhyamaka school understand.
Okay, Madhyamaka is just a Sanskrit name for middle way. The sky flower, flowers don't exist in the sky, so it's something that just simply doesn't exist. Or another example sometimes that's used is the horns of a rabbit. Normally, rabbits don't have horns, so you can't talk about them as if they were something. They don't exist, so it's non-existent. So the mind is non-existent, but it's also not non-existent. I mean, we have a mind. We have this appearance of, but we're in the ultimate truth level here. The appearance is on the relative level. It doesn't exist. It's not non-existent, and it's not both existent and non-existent, and it's not neither existent nor non-existent. So those are the four extremes, and it's none of those. So we're eliminating what it is, or the false view of it, basically. Okay? And that's the position of the middle way, the Madhyamaka school. Okay?
That the mind is empty of the four conceptual extremes. This emptiness is not a mere mental conception, but is free from the four conceptual extremes, and this is, from the beginning, the nature of its own being.
So there's an example from the beginning, what I just said, except there's no beginning. What it means is, from beginningless time.
Through not being parted from the wisdom which is understood to be free from the four conceptual extremes, relax the mind for a while in the state in which even the discriminating wisdom itself does not appear. The state which is devoid of perception, which is the clear light, free from conceptual extremes, and in which it, i.e. the mind, does not exist in any form whatsoever. This is the instruction for cutting the conceptual activity of grasping the characteristics of entities. As it was said in the Bodhicharya Avatara, when neither an entity nor a non-entity remain before the mind, at that time, since it lacks any other aspects, the unsupported mind achieves quiescence.
So if we go through this process, this meditative process, where we end up is peace. Because all this conceptualization is just non-existent anyway. It's just appearance. But when we let the mind settle, all that just sort of dissolves.
Through meditating in that way for a long time, without inference from sluggishness or and unruliness.
Interference,
right. From sluggishness and unruliness, one's meditation will experience a state devoid of appearances, like space. Subsequent to that meditation, there will arise the experience of understanding all phenomena to be non-dual appearance and emptiness, like magical illusions.
Okay, so we've gone through this logical analysis and scriptural verification, but the real experience of it comes when you're meditating, the actual meditative experience. And as it says, it takes a long time to get there. Without sluggishness and unruliness, what are those two refer to?
Laziness and...
Not laziness, but...
No effort or like no desire to...
It's one of the faults. So laziness is the first fault. Forgetfulness is the second fault. What's the third fault?
Not taking it seriously? No.
Thinking and scattering. These are synonyms. Sluggishness and unruliness are synonyms for thinking and scattering. Yeah. So in other words, scattering, your mind goes on, monkey mind, discursive, blah, 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 blah. Or thinking is going down in various degrees of somnambulance. Okay. So those are the two things. When you meditate without those, eventually, one's meditative state will experience a state devoid of appearances, like space. And subsequent to that meditation, there will arise the experience of understanding that all phenomena to be non-dual appearance and emptiness, like magical illusions. So we read about it, and we think about it, and we're told it's like a magical illusion or a dream or those examples that are given. But when you actually go through this process, you actually have the experience of it. It's not just something that you read or somebody told you. You actually have the experience. Okay, so that's all of number two of the realization of selflessness. And now we're going to go to number three. Do you want to keep going or do you want to pass?
No. Develop the unshakable understanding that the nature of mind is inexpressible. It may be asked, should one accept the nature of mind which is free from the four conceptual extremes to be the ultimate truth of itself, truth itself. This is also not the case, since each of the four conceptual extremes that are to be refuted do not exist. There cannot be something known as devoid of the conceptual extremes, which is the refutation of the four extremes as truly existent in the ultimate sense. Therefore, that which is known as the middle path, free from the conceptual extremes, is also inexpressible. The ultimate truth completely transcends all objects of speech and conception.
Okay, this is where it gets kind of challenging, because what they're really saying is, anything we say about this is not true. It's inexpressible. That's why you only get there when you meditate. You don't get there reading a book. The ultimate truth is beyond words. It's beyond expression. It's inexpressible. And as soon as you start to try to express it, you've missed it. Because that's a label. Words are labels, right?
Mm-hmm. That's true. As it was said in the sutra, what are known as existence and non-existence are conceptual extremes, and what are called pure and impure are also conceptual extremes. Therefore, having discarded any two conceptual extremes, the wise should not even abide in the middle.
So they give it to you and then they take it away. Because even that is a label. Even that is a concept. But we had to get there somehow, right? Otherwise we just would be lost.
Mm-hmm. Further, it was taught by Jetsun Rinpoche in a song, the term free from conceptual extremes transcends the object of expressibility. Such words as middle path, Mariamaka, mind only, Chittamatra, and the like are activities of expression, and all thoughts arising with the mind are conceptualizations. Again, Jetsun Rinpoche said, having failed to understand the true nature of self-arising wisdom, and having failed to become accustomed to the special instruction of non-grasping, whatever one thinks still falls within the sphere of grasping. Further, if one thinks of non-grasping, this also falls within the sphere of grasping. So understand that the merging together of the emptiness and the non-ceasing clarity of mind is the ultimate truth.
Okay, so there you can put a star by that last line. Because we've been arriving to this point, trying to figure out, well, what is ultimate truth? And so, Drapa Gyaltsen says, the merging together of the emptiness and the non-ceasing clarity of mind is the ultimate truth. So, again, we've gotten to this point by first setting the mind only, which emphasizes the non-ceasing clarity. And then we studied Madhyamaka, which emphasizes the emptiness. And we need to have both of those together, okay? Because you're going to see this appearance of this light, the clear light. You're going to see it, so it appears. So the mind has a certain clarity to it, a certain light, if you want. But it's empty. And we need to merge those. And when we do, those two together are the ultimate truth.
In this way, one should first thoroughly cut through all doubts and false assumptions by means of study and contemplation. At the time of the practice of meditation, place the mind within the state of non-ceasing clarity. The nature of that very mind cannot be expressed as free from conceptual extremes, nor expressed as not free from conceptual extremes. Nor is there anything to be refuted by refutations, nor is there anything to be accomplished through practice. Nor is there anything to be discarded through abandonment. Nor is there any antidotes to be relied upon. Nor is there any worldly existence, samsara, to be abandoned. Nor is there any liberation, nirvana, to be obtained. Nor is there any hope of Buddhahood. Without any hope, doubt, all these conceptualizations, such as acceptance and rejection, ascertainment and refutation, hope and doubt, existence and non-existence, emptiness and non-emptiness, and so on, are mere names, mere signs, mere convention, mere expression, collections, hollow things, meaningless, essenceless, pure from the beginning, empty from the beginning, and free from the beginning. So, through not being parted from the unshakable understanding that mind transcends all objects of speech, thought, and expressibility. Keep the mind without distractions in the manner of being free from meditator and subject of meditation. As both the Master Maitreya and the Noble Nagarjuna said, there is nothing whatsoever to be dispelled in ultimate truth, and there is not the least to be established in ultimate truth. One should perfectly perceive the right view. If one sees rightly, one will be completely liberated.
Okay, so the view is talked about a lot in different scriptures and texts and so on and so forth. So the middle way view, when they say the view, this is what they're talking about, okay? That all of these things that we just read, all these labels on the ultimate level, they're not real.
Further, Sakya Pandita said, the true nature of entities is devoid of existence, non-existence, and the like. There is no process of meditation consisting of a meditation, a subject of meditation, and so on. Since the mind is devoid of essence, there is no description of mind to be of certain qualities. Since it transcends the object of words, there is nothing whatsoever to be described.
We talk about mind because we're in this state of delusion, but actually, when you get into texts that talk about the description of Buddha and Buddhahood, they don't use the word mind for Buddha. In fact, they say Buddha doesn't have a mind, he has wisdom. And so what we call mind on the ultimate level, it doesn't exist.
All of this can be confirmed by the precious discourses of the Buddha, as it was said in the sutra.
That's the father-disciple meeting.
Since there is no phenomena that can be perceived in ultimate truth, so there is nothing whatsoever that can be ascribed. In other words, these are mere names, mere signs, mere convention, mere expression, and mere ascription. Other than that, relative truth, all phenomena are non-perceptible in the ultimate truth. Also, it was said in the Bodhisattva Pitaka Sutra, when one does not accept or reject all phenomena, one will not abide in all phenomena. When one does not abide in all phenomena, one neither originates or ceases. When one does not originate and cease, one will be completely liberated from birth, old age, disease, death, sorrow, lamenting, suffering, unhappiness of mind, and agitation of mind.
So this is another way of saying that if you do this meditation and you accomplish it, you'll be enlightened.
Moreover, in the sutras of the Pranaparamita,
Prajnaparamita, perfection of wisdom,
it is said, by conceptualizing, one will be involved in the realm of desire, the realm of form, and the formless realm. By the lack of conceptualizing, one will be involved nowhere. Again, it was stated in the same text, since enlightenment is imperceptible, so the term enlightenment is merely a name. Since Buddha is imperceptible, so the term Buddha is merely a name. The omniscient Buddha has no essence, and whatever is devoid of its own nature is inexpressible. It may be asked, well then, how can one work for sentient beings? The answer is that, when there are no sentient beings in ultimate truth, there is no need to talk about work to be performed for the sake of sentient beings, or about the one who works. As it was said in the Pranaparamita Sutra, while I was dwelling under the Bodhi tree, I gained the complete Buddhahood of the unsurpassable, full and perfect enlightenment. At that time, I did not perceive sentient beings, and I did not even perceive the name sentient beings. Again, it was said in the sutras, Sabuti, I do not perceive any sentient being. However, sentient beings who lack substantiality are perceived as substantial by sentient beings. Therefore, working for their welfare is the mere conventional imputation of worldlings. However, this does not exist in the ultimate truth. If one realizes in this way, then grasping the mere state of the inexpressible as the ultimate truth will cease. As it was said in the Bodhicaryavatara, through the habituation of the mental impression of emptiness, one will get rid of mental impressions of existing entities. Through the habituation that nothing whatsoever exists, finally one will discard that notion of emptiness.
Okay, at the risk of repeating this again, we're talking in the ultimate sense here. Obviously, if we're talking in the relative sense, there are sentient beings to be helped, there is merit to be accumulated, there is practice to be done, there are attainments to be attained. So just keep that in mind. That doesn't mean, oh, well, there's nothing, we don't do anything. That's nihilism.
Having understood thus, if one meditates, one will experience the non-grasping of clarity and emptiness during one's meditation session. Subsequent to that meditation session, spontaneous compassion for worldlings will arise in one's grasping mind.
Yeah, we mentioned this before one time, that when obviously this is a very advanced kind of meditation we're talking about here, but when you get to this stage, you have spontaneous compassion for all the poor souls who don't get it, for the rest of us that are stuck in samsara with our delusions and our projections and our relative way of seeing things. But once you attain this level, the compassion just spontaneously arises.
For these reasons, those who wish to uproot the two obscurations along with their residual mental impressions and to obtain quickly the stage of omniscience should diligently meditate upon wisdom, the true meaning of emptiness.
Okay, so this is kind of the summary, saying you really want to do this. You really want to do this meditation if you want to get out of samsara. If you want to uproot the two obscurations. What are the two obscurations? Anybody remember that? So you have your defilements, your negative emotions, you have those obscurations, and then you have the obscuration to wisdom. Or sometimes it's called the obscuration to knowledge. So you have to clean up your negativity, right? And you have to accomplish wisdom. This section here that we're reading, that has to be accomplished. So those are called the two obscurations. We're blocked on the emotional level and we're blocked on the knowledge level. It's a kind of a simple way of saying it. So if you wish to uproot those, yeah?
So could you say that it's the coarse and the subtle obscurations?
I don't know. Is that the way people talk about it sometimes?
I seem to recall that there are coarse and subtle obscurations.
I'm not sure.
That's the distinction between the two.
I'm not sure either. Anyway, if you want to uproot those, which presumably we do, and you want to quickly obtain omniscience, then meditate on wisdom, which is the true meaning of emptiness. And then what does Shantideva say about that?
Emptiness is the antidote to the darkness of the obscurations of afflictions and knowable objects. Why should one who desires to quickly attain omniscience not meditate on emptiness? To realize emptiness, one should train in the collection of the vast accumulation of merit. Otherwise, it is difficult to realize emptiness, and even if it is realized, one will fall into states such as the cessation of the shavakas and the like. As it was said in the Sanchayagata Sutra, as long as the root of virtue is not completely accumulated, the realization of sacred emptiness will not be accomplished.
Okay, so this is something we've talked about lots of times, that the first five perfections have to do with the accumulation of merit, or here it's referred to as virtue, and that spiritual energy or that spiritual momentum is what allows you to realize this whole emptiness wisdom thing, which is, just reading it kind of makes your head spin. The merit is what allows the realization of that. You have to, in other words, you have to be spiritually evolved enough to do this realization of emptiness. It's not easy. It's not something that just, oh, yeah, no problem, I'll do that after dinner tonight. We have to accumulate this energy, this merit, this positive spiritual energy, all these activities the five perfections provide, and all the spiritual practices that we have that accumulate merit. That's the energy that really supports and is, it's a requirement really for grasping and realizing this wisdom. And that is what's enlightenment. A word we hear all the time, but who really knows what we're talking about? That's what we're talking about here.
Also, the Master Sakya Pandita said, emptiness is also meditated upon by Shravakas, but its result is gaining cessation.
Yeah, that is important, I think, to understand that the understanding of emptiness has levels too. So the Shravakas, those are the foundation path people, they have an understanding of emptiness, but it's not complete.
They haven't realized it yet.
They haven't realized the emptiness of phenomena. They've realized the emptiness of self. I'm speaking very generally here, okay? And that's one of the distinctions between the foundation path and the greater vehicle path, is the greater vehicle path realizes both kinds of selflessness, the selflessness of self and the selflessness of phenomena. So what Sakya Pandita is saying, they also meditate on emptiness, but they only take it so far. They only take it so far as cessation. Remember the four noble truths? I think we did that on the first class, didn't we? The four noble truths. Everybody remembers those, of course. Mm-hmm. Okay, so cessation of suffering. It's the cessation of suffering and the cessation of the causes of suffering. So the foundation path folks, they have that. They have that practice. But this middle way takes it further till we have the selflessness of phenomena as well. Okay? And we need both of those to really get the true nature of reality, which is another way of saying enlightenment. Enlightenment is achieving the, or attaining the wisdom of the true nature of reality. That's what it is.
Therefore, to practice wisdom and method inseparably is the essence of the Mahayana path.
Let's hold on here. Let me just see if we should stop here or not, because it gets kind of thick at this point. Yeah, let's stop here. That's quite a bit to digest. Hopefully people have a chance this week to kind of go through that again. This is somewhat deep philosophy. We're going to later learn how to actually do the mechanics of the meditation, but we had to do sort of the theoretical part first so that we understood kind of what we were talking about before we go into the meditation. Because remember, the second step of contemplation is just that, understanding it clearly, what it is, what it isn't. Do I have any questions? Do I need to clarify this? And we need to do that, so I would invite you to do that this week. See if you can get as much as possible, get this clear in your mind, and then next time we'll go into the actual meditation part of it.
Okay.
So that's your homework. Any comments people want to make at this point? Okay, let's say our dedication now.
So
nam dehi tam che zingpani Dog na ni pe da nam pam je te Ke ga na chi ba lung tu pe yi Sit pe so re do wa do hun shu Chang chu sin cho grin po che Ma ke pa nam ke gyu chi Ke ma nam par ne Gong ne gong tu pel par shu Jam pa pa wo ji tar ken pa dam Kun du By this merit, may all attain omniscience, may it defeat the enemy wrongdoing, for the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may all beings be free. Bodhicitta is precious, may it arise in all beings in whom it has not arisen, may it never decline where it has arisen, may it ever grow and flourish. In whatever way, valiant Manjushri and Samantabhadra know how to transfer merit, so do I dedicate all my own virtues, that I might train to be like them. Through this dedication, praise the Supreme, by the victorious Buddhas of the past, present, and future, I, together with all sentient beings, dedicate these roots of virtue to attaining Buddhahood. May whatever little virtue I may have gained from prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, requesting, and beseeching be dedicated to attaining perfect enlightenment. Thank you.
Thank you.